cliffcentral.com.
This morning, as always, joined by our returning champion, Canton Pillay. Canton, it's good to see you.
Likewise.
And I see you had a triple shot of coffee this morning.
Yeah, it was a pretty late night. My three-year-old, you know, ends up going around like this, one of these Energizer bunnies. And by the time she eventually gets to bed, and I have a 5 a.m. wake-up call.
You know, a lot of people don't know that you're also a father. among all the other things that you do, you're also a father. So there are lots of things to talk about this morning in terms of current affairs. I don't know how up-to-date you are, but people want to know what's happening. People want to know what the most interesting stories are in the news. I see lots of people talking about Duduzane Zuma this week, but really, it's not. It's a bit of a distraction.
It is a distraction.
This whole commission is, in fact, a gigantic waste of money in some respects, because what people don't seem to understand about the State Capture Commission is that it has no teeth. And yeah, you know, we need to keep reminding ourselves of this. The people who already know it, I'm sorry for being repetitive, but a state capture commission is really just a fact-finding mission, effectively, to try to bring into the open what has largely been hidden away. What Duduzane Zuma had to say this week was so curated and so managed by his legal team that he was doing a performance.
Well, that was exactly one of the points I was touching on with some friends when we were discussing this. I wanted to know who had coached him.
Because they did a good job.
The performance was superb. I mean, the guy was a natural, you know. He just had exactly the right elements of smiling when necessary, trying to be charming, being...
Well, he's got good genes for those things.
Yeah, certainly.
His father is capable of all of that, too.
His father's a past master at all of that. But this performance was very polished. It was very slick. And I'm pretty convinced that there's some... new type of agency out there. Maybe it's a Bell Pottinger type thing that whose sole purpose is to coach people in doing this type of thing. Because remember, his lawyers cannot coach him in what to say, because that if it ever transpired that it was brought to court that the lawyers had done this, they'd be struck off the roll. So maybe there's a bit of a niche market there. Maybe, Gareth, you could teach people how to be charming. I don't have a clue how to do that.
I don't know. Some people don't think I'm charming at all. You have to be a bit of an empty vessel, though, to learn this stuff.
Yeah, pretty much. But that's...
And he doesn't have other stuff to do, as far as I can tell.
But the same is true for all actors, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes. Like Greta Thunberg. But people are impressed by that.
Someone's done a death metal remix of Greta Thunberg.
I know. Well, good for her. And you know what? I mean, here we are a week or two later, and the people who were all fanatical about her just a couple of days ago have completely left her by the wayside, and they're now moving on.
Oh, that's because the polar ice caps didn't melt in the past week.
All right. So many things to pay attention to that aren't just performances, though. We see... Robert McBride and the story of IPID that keeps coming up, and Busisiwe Mkhwebane, her reports have been taken on review. It's interesting, a battlefront has been opened against the public protector as the former head of IPID, that's Robert McBride, and seven others, including the watchdog body's head of investigations, take one of Busisiwe Mkhwebane's reports on review. What does this mean, and what is the story with IPID? I'm really struggling to understand who the good guys and the bad guys are here. And I hate to even be as binary as to say good guys and bad guys, because obviously it's all shades of grey. But in respect of IPID and Robert McBride, we know that he was trying to bring to light a number of goings-on in the police that were unsavory, to say the least. And Robert McBride has a checkered past himself. He's definitely a cadre who was deployed, so we can take everything he says with a pinch of salt. But now he's up against Busisiwe Mkhwebane. I'm struggling to see what this is. Is it yet another sideshow?
I think we're going to have to wait for what happens when this finally ends up coming before court. But remember, essentially what we're looking at in terms of the state of the country right now is... one faction of the ANC versus another faction of the ANC.
That's the meta
and
story.
That's the meta story. And the best that we can hope for in this lot is that they are still enough people of integrity within the ANC structures, and there's still a handful of them left. I don't want to go into naming names. You know, they're down at the bottom. They've been beaten into submission, but they still try and get up in the morning and say, we want to live up to the values that we believed in the Freedom Charter and all of that kind of stuff. And so really,
idealists.
They're idealists. So, and really what we're hoping is that amidst that lot, there's enough people who are saying, well, I'm going to try to do my job as best as I can in the midst of all of the stuff that's going around with my comrades ending up wanting to basically feather their own nests. And I think the case in terms of, if you take McBride as a very specific case in point, remember that, well, McBride, of course, had, you know, the Magoo's Bar bombing, but we'd write that off because that was, after all, that was political, that was part of the war, and he did the right thing. You know, he begged for forgiveness from the people, and he hugged the guy that was blinded, and we put that behind us with the TRC. Then there was the drunk driving incident that he tried to cover up, but then he went across to IPED, and the stuff that he tried to do at the Independent Police Investigate Directorate was to try and actually highlight abuses that were taking place within police structures. But of course, he was appointed at a time that the police minister was not appointed. And so at the point at which he starts investigating people who are then no longer in favor who now become in favor with the current authorities, then that's where the conflict really comes from. But were there some investigations that came out under McBride that that really were needed to be done? They actually shone the light, the spotlight on stuff that needed to be brought to the public attention. Yes, it did.
Yeah,
the cool thing about taking it on review is that it has to go to court, and then the entire thing actually gets properly unpacked before the courts, because then it's no longer a question of whose agenda is there, but the courts actually expose everything. And that's the point at which we actually get the sense of what the real story is. Well, so I hope.
So it could bring a whole lot of facts to light that we don't currently know about.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, in that case, we should watch this closely. While we're talking about court, Alta took Dudu Mieni to court. She says she's too poor to come to court in Pretoria. So this is breaking news that's just happened to the High Court in Pretoria. This is Thursday morning, expected to hear the matter between the Outer people and Dudu Mieni, who's the former chairperson of SAA and the current chairperson of the Jacob Zuma Foundation, and a director on at least 4 boards, but at some point she was also on 27 others. So she just has no money.
Life is really tough. You know, and you know, we have actors and actresses who, you know, are getting paid 100,000 rand a pop, and you know, they think that they're exploited.
Yes.
Yeah. We really have things really rough in our country. But going back to Dudu Mieni, essentially her lawyers pitched up at court, and let me rephrase that: a lawyer who pitched up not in a representative capacity, but as a friend of Dudu Mieni, for want of a better word.
Like makes an agent of hers.
Yeah, look, I don't want to use the word agent because that sounds kind of shady.
No, no, and, I mean yeah, in the legal sense.
Yeah, for sure.
You ask someone to represent you.
I think the point that I'm trying to make is that said person was not there in a representative capacity other than to be a message taker. But said person said, well, actually, she was under the impression that legal representation would be provided by SAA. And that's the reason why that she was waiting. So let's wait and see where that goes. I think she'll be hard-pressed, though, to actually claim that she's poor. Because where does she live? I think she lives in one of those relatively well-guarded, gated communities.
Is that where she lives?
So I've been told.
Hmm.
Yeah, we're not on the same WhatsApp group.
Wow. But she did well when Jacob Zuma was president. She was very important, and she seems to have made a lot of money. And now suddenly she doesn't have any, which means that she's really bad at managing money, so she should be declared delinquent. Even just on her own evidence.
Well, look, frankly, going back to the Sata court case, if I did a CIPC search on on Dudumieni, and yeah, in fact, she's on the board of three companies effectively, because the fourth one is some sort of trust that's in deregistration. Okay. So effectively, it's three, one of which is clearly her own CC, because she's the sole director on there, which, you know, one can probably assume that that's not pulling any money.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the Jacob Zuma Foundation. And the interesting one for me was the other one, which is a company called Centlec, which is actually providing electricity in the greater Mangaung area. Hmm. And it's, yeah, so centlec.co.za for anyone who wants to go in and check it out. She's still listed on the board of Centlec, and that's a state-owned enterprise. But the point that I'm getting at is that if Outa is going to court to declare a delinquent director, I'm afraid the ship has already sailed, because there's a list of 21 companies there. She's resigned from all of those boards. So
what's the point?
What's the point? Yeah, so I think, you know, Dudu's ship has sailed. I think Outa should really move on from there.
Okay, it's a vanity project.
I don't know. I think at the point at which they started off, they might have been under the impression that she was a director of 13 companies at the time. And that might well have been true. But I think it's important to just keep up to date with the movement of directors on companies.
All right. Well, we'll try and keep an eye on that one too, because obviously Dudumieni is at very least a character of some controversy in South Africa. And I think people, you know, we tend to glum all of our irritation and we project all of our unhappiness at one or two people because they're the ones who seem to be the embodiment of corruption and of arrogance. And certainly in her case, she has done nothing to make herself favorable in our opinions, because of the way she's behaved over the last couple of years. She was adamant that she'd done nothing wrong at SAA, despite being on the board that drove SAA to complete ruin. They're still trying to climb out of that hole, and government bailout after government bailout after government bailout doesn't seem to be able to get SAA back on track. I've heard all kinds of stories, including that the people who run SAA, who manage it, are also the people who are running a number of illegal drug import rackets, and it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, that sounds like hearsay, so I can't back it up with anything.
Well, we did have that case of the SAA flight attendants who were bust.
Yeah, but occasionally they do one of these busts to show that, you know, they're on top of things, but who knows what else is going on behind the scenes. Either way, it's very badly run. Let's just say on the books.
Here's the interesting thing for me in terms of the Dudumieni story right now, and we do a comparison of what's happening with Peter Moyo versus Old Mutual.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's what's interesting is that Moyo's done, from a strategic point of view, it's actually a very smart move, which is to go after the directors of Old Mutual in their personal capacities. And if you end up setting a precedent in terms of the Moyo case, I'm really curious as to whether people then turn around and go after the directors of SAA in their personal capacities as well. So
I think we should.
Yeah,
aren't they normally held jointly and severally liable?
Yes, which is why when, you know, I was sitting on all of those boards, well, I still sit on a couple of boards, but they're not at the level of, you know, subsidiaries of listed companies. But you basically ended up having insurance against potential malpractice while sitting on the board, you know, for which you actually paid. But I suspect that that's very much the case in terms of the current board of Old Mutual. But clearly the insurance wouldn't apply retrospectively to the likes of Dudumieni. I don't know. This is all speculation on my part right now. But I'm watching. We've had this discussion before about watching a train wreck in slow motion, and you don't want the train to crash, but it's still kind of fascinating. It's like, all right, I can't stop this crash happening, so let's just sit back and watch.
Speaking of train crashes, Eskom, President Ramaphosa said on Wednesday, the paper setting out the roadmap for Eskom's future would be tabled before cabinet shortly. It seems to have taken him a very long time to get this going. What do we think of the plans that he's already intimated he's tabling, and what do we think of the timelines that he's suggested?
Well, Treasury's put a bill before Parliament for the Eskom bailout, basically, and it puts in place a a whole range of terms and conditions under which this is actually going across. So one of the things is that the money goes very specifically for paying off debt. And it quite explicitly says that no money shall be used to pay bonuses or any incentives to staff. And it also requires that there be weekly reports from Eskom, that there be monthly reports from Eskom in terms of cash flow and all of that kind of stuff.
And the president obviously appointed that 18-member council to advise him and government on developing and implementing social...
Yeah, that's kind of a different story. And I think the 18-member council, they started work now. But remember, they've got a three-year term of office.
Yes.
Yeah, so I think that we're pretty much going to have to wait for the next 3 years. Well, what's kind of interesting for me is that if you look at... the stuff around the 18-member council, and when Ramaphosa was making his great announcement around that yesterday, it was very much a recap of things that he said in State of the Nation address and all of that kind of stuff. I think what's far more interesting is the stuff that's happening behind the scenes, like the Treasury bill around exactly how the money now ends up getting spent at Eskom. I think those are the spaces that we need to watch. I don't expect anything to come out of the 18-member council other than the fact that people get the sense of comfort that there are some competent people on this council, and they hoping that they're actually getting good advice from that the president's getting good advice from them. On the other hand, I think that Mboweni actually has already knows what to do.
Well, he put out a very cogent document not so long ago.
Yes.
And he released it publicly and then had to withdraw it and apologize.
Well, he didn't apologize. He just said that...
he apologized for putting it out publicly. He didn't apologize.
Did he really?
He was forced to.
I must have missed that. Yeah. All right. Yeah, I think that was basically to assuage Kosatu to some extent, who were upset that he had tabled a discussion document before discussing it.
Well, these are all political procedures.
Yes, but we like
more or less what he had to say.
Yes, well, but remember that stuff then went to the NEC, and well, the NEC said, well, we think that this is a great starting point, but actually we're not going to allow you to privatize SA, we're not going to allow you to privatize Eskom, et cetera, et cetera. But I do like the Treasury bill, because for the first time, it's not just... flushing money down the toilet. This is actually a question of saying, we're giving you this money for this specific reason, and we're going to be watching you pretty much on a daily basis to see how this money is being spent.
Well, let's see what happens there too.
Another interesting thing about Eskom, by the way, which we must pick up on, because, you know, I've been pushing for the longest time for people to go off grid.
Yes, you have.
Yes. Yeah. Now, Eskom is now proposing that they change their pricing model. Now, essentially what this means is that if you remember the old days when we all had landlines,
yes,
and some of us listening right now are saying, what's a landline? Okay, but we used to pay Telkom a line rental, so that there'd be a couple of hundred rand a month for the physical cable that comes into your place, and then we pay a usage charge over and above that, which was basically your airtime.
Yeah.
And we pretty much have the same thing in terms of Eskom, where we pay a certain amount for the infrastructure cost of actually
connecting your house
to the grid, essentially, and maintaining the meter, and then you pay them for usage on top of that. And so the connection fee right now is very small, and the usage fee is quite large.
Yes.
And they're proposing to swap that around. So they want to crank up the amount of money that you pay simply to be connected to the grid. Mm-hmm. So that even if you go off grid with solar and you're using the grid as a backup, you're still going to end up paying Eskom a disproportionately large
amount. The problem is that we've already got the connection. You can't charge someone something different for something
you're already paying a monthly fee for the connection. So they're proposing that they actually raise that monthly fee. Look, to some extent...
extortion.
It is extortion. And let's see whether it actually manages to get through Parliament, because I think that there's going to be lots of upset people around that. Because the problem around wanting to do that... I mean, right now we have the staggered scale. Eskom's the only product in the world where you pay more the more you use.
Yeah.
And
you pay more.
No.
In fact, it's also the only product that I can think of where they encourage you to use less.
Yes, to not use their product.
And then they charge you more depending on how much you use. In other words, the pro rata rate goes up.
But right now, the scenario is that Eskom can still argue that they are pro-poor, in the sense that poor people end up paying less because they use less electricity. Whereas when you go to a flat rate connection structure, it'd be really difficult for them to justify charging every household in the country R1,000 a month, say, as a connection
fee. Yeah, but most of the, in inverted commas, poor that Eskom is
you see, I didn't want to bring up
condescending
the point.
To.
I didn't want to bring up the point about Soweto not paying because Pumi's not here.
But this is what I wanted to get to, is that most of those people aren't paying anyway and have illegal connections.
Yes, well, that's...
How much would an illegal connection cost? Is there a two-tier system there?
Yes, there is a two-tier system there. But interestingly, another thing in terms of the bill that Treasury put before Parliament is that they're also asking for Eskom to go out of its way to recover those monies.
Let's see how that goes. It's not. I'm not imagining a very
well. There was
the
court case that happened in of Newcastle versus Eskom this week. Well, because Newcastle is the city of Newcastle. We're talking
about the municipality.
Yeah, the municipality is owing $200 million to Eskom.
Where's that money? They collected it from residents.
Yes. Well, Eskom was going to shut them off, and so the municipality took Eskom to court, and the court ruled, well, no, Eskom, you can't disconnect these guys. But the court did rule that the municipality needs to pay Eskom $30 million a month, which will continue through until around about December, which is the point at which the court is going to hear the case again.
But it's interesting. So,
how does Eskom work? Eskom tries to recover the money, and Eskom says, we're going to disconnect you for non-payment. And the court say, no, actually, we can't.
Yeah, but if that aside, how does it work? The people of Newcastle have no doubt been paying their electricity.
Oh, I would assume, yes.
So that money goes then into the municipal coffers?
Yes, kind of like where most people in Johannesburg pay city power.
Right, and then they're meant to pass over that to Eskom for, obviously, the cost of the electricity and the provision of services and, you know, infrastructure and all the rest of it. So it's a straightforward transaction.
Yes.
And if you don't pay, you don't get. I understand that the court may be doing this on the basis of what, human dignity, human rights, all that kind of thing.
No, I don't think so. I think the court also took into account that there's significant business interests in Eskom who joined, Newcastle, who joined with the municipality in the application, because I think Newcastle is like one of the world's single biggest sources of chrome, as an example.
Well, that's all good and well, but where is the money? Where is the money that was taken from residents and businesses in Newcastle for electricity?
Well, as the mayor was saying, well, you know, the money's there. We just have a cash flow problem and we'll sort this out eventually. Mm. But anyway, the courts
have... shouldn't be a cash flow problem.
Yes, exactly. But the courts have said, well, we're going to pay 30... you are going to have to pay $30 million per month, and let's take it from there.
All right. Okay, the DA is having, it just seems to be in a death spiral at the moment. Who's in charge there? What's going on? Who's making the puppets dance in the DA? Helen Ziller's made herself available as the national chairperson, and we thought that she'd left politics. What's going on?
Refer my earlier comments about the train crash in slow motion.
Yes.
And now let's apply the same logic.
Okay, but explain it to me.
Okay. Short explanation is that for the first time since 1994, the DA went backwards in this election that we've just completed.
Yeah. Now, we know they're on the back foot.
Yeah.
They're very uncomfortable.
So immediately,
who do they blame?
Yeah. No, I don't think it's who do they blame. But the question is, what happens is if a political leader actually ends up taking the party backwards, I think that that's immediately the time at which you turn around and say it's time for new leadership. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, for example, if the DA was a corporate, then the CEO would probably have been fired for non-performance.
And you're saying, when you talk about leadership, you're talking about Musi Maimane, and you're talking about James Self, and you're talking about all of those people.
I'm talking about all of those people. So, really, I view this as a question of people in the DA now saying, actually, we have seriously screwed up on this one. How do we turn this around? And so there's a number of people who are now wanting to be coming forward and actually throwing their hats in the ring. And what's really interesting for me is how the DA, the party of purportedly liberal values now has a significant chunk of people who are starting to play the race card.
Well, Phumzile Van Dam among them, she also has been putting out all kinds of interesting information about how the IRR, which is a non-profit organization, it certainly doesn't make money, but it's a think tank effectively outside the DA, has managed to, according to her anyway, manipulate the DA to move in a certain direction. What you're seeing there is the same kind of factionalism starting to
develop as in the ANC. Well, the IRR, first and foremost, and understand that I have no skin in the game with the IRR, but the IRR, going back to the apartheid era, was doing exactly the same thing. They were always a classically liberal think tank.
Yeah.
And what that meant was that they always promoted classically liberal values. So this is the reason why the IRR used to go after the apartheid government during the apartheid era for doing exactly the same thing, for putting in place race-based policies, for not actually pushing free market fundamentals, all of that kind of good stuff. So does the IRR have a vested interest in a DA that is non-racial and democratic and adhering to its values? Absolutely. I also suspect that the IRR has a strong interest in pushing that agenda with the ANC and with just about every political party. I do know that the IRR regularly holds briefings with all of the political parties, including the ANC, where they share these insights and so forth. But whether the IRR is actually interfering directly in the DA, no, I find that highly unlikely, even though there's a lot of people in the DA who have come from within the ranks of the IRR.
Yeah, but what is this paranoia then?
Well, the paranoia is people are really terrified at the idea that Helen Ziller might once again become influential within the DA. And frankly, I think she will.
And would that be a good thing or a bad thing? I mean,
look, I have no skin in the game in terms of the DA. Do I think that Helen Ziller is hugely popular on the ground with DA supporters, irrespective of what the Twitterati may think? Yes, very much so. Because, you know, I remember occasions.
Well, she is the one who took the DA up in the rankings and managed to increase membership.
Yeah, well, you know, Tony.
Certainly didn't happen before or after.
No, Tony Leon, you know, to, you know, in as much as I really despised his fight back campaign, it worked.
Yeah.
And he actually built up that significant base. Then he screwed up by going into an alliance with the Nats, and then the Nats fled back into the ANC, but everyone thinks that the Nats are still within the DA. And so that legacy has lived on with this whole party of apartheid narrative. Then you had Helen Ziller, who then actually clawed the party back into a position of significant power, and then actually did something really stupid, which was to try and popularize the DA instead of sticking to core values. And I think really what she's trying to do now is to undo the mess that she caused in the first place. And I think that there's lots of people who would actually like to see her doing that. But interesting thing from the point of view of people like Herman Mashaba, for example.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Herman. And Herman's been doing a lot of things that are actually contrary to the core values of the DA. So I think a lot of people voted for the DA in Johannesburg in the municipal elections. Certainly I was one of them. And the reason why I voted for Mashaba, we've talked about this before, I wanted him to do just three things. I wanted him to fix the traffic lights, I wanted him to fix the potholes, and I wanted him to clean up the rubbish. And it was only those three things because, you know, municipal elections, it's not about nation building, it's not about fixing poverty, none of those things. But he has not fixed the traffic lights, he has not fixed the potholes, he has not cleaned up the trash. Instead, what he has done is he has insourced workers, which is part of his quid pro quo with the EFF, because they basically said, okay, step number one, you eliminate all of the cycling lanes. So Mashaba did that first thing when he came into office. Then you insource your workers, whereas really what one should have done is taken institutions like Pick It Up and broken them up into small, independent, and I'm very happy to say black-run companies, black-owned companies, but if you have small, independent companies that are responsible for specific areas, what that means is that if you then have a trash collection problem with one specific place, it doesn't mean that the entire city shuts down. So Yeah, Mashaba is...
But Mashaba's using it for that reason. First of all, to placate the EFF. That's been one of his major goals.
Yes.
But he's also using it as a platform for himself on the national stage. And Sia and Gugu and I were talking about this earlier, Canton, and it's something that I think we might want to hear some thoughts from you on. Local government should be the most important in people's lives. Local government is where services or the non-delivery of services take place, water, electricity, sewage, rubbish, the things that really affect people on a day-to-day basis. The most important interface between people and government should be at local and municipal level. It also should have the lion's share of budgets and of responsibilities. And national government, which is far away in the distance, should almost perform an administrative role in terms of making sure that the municipalities do their job, ideally.
Yes, ideally. But what's interesting is if one looks at the level of the way in which elections have been playing themselves out at the municipal level, we saw in the last round of by-elections, because you remember that the ANC did this purge of a number of municipalities, and then a lot of the councillors that they purged in those municipalities then came forward and stood as independents and ended up winning those seats as independents. Mm-hmm. And that, for me, is a very interesting way forward, because I think that's real grassroots democracy. You have a scenario where people in a particular ward get themselves organized, get together, and they back a candidate from their ward and put that person forward in the municipality. And I think that's going to be the wave of the next municipal elections. And I think that there's an opportunity in terms of someone actually putting together a digital platform that's able to actually coordinate the way in which people do that type of thing. And it's sort of really driving grassroots democracy at the level of municipalities. And I think that that's going to be a signal change in 2 years' time. I know lots of people who are playing in that space right now to try and break the stranglehold of the parties on democracy.
And the losers there would be the parties.
The losers there absolutely would be the parties. The parties would still get... remember, the municipal elections have... you have directly elected councillors, and then you have proportional representation councils.
Yeah.
So you'll still have people get in on the proportional representation ballot. And so the parties will still... but you'll end up in a scenario that's not dissimilar to what's happening in Nelson Mandela Bay right now, where it basically becomes dysfunctional. But dysfunctional is better than having a single party that's able to spend the budget.
In other news, this is something which probably will affect people. The Commission for Employment Equity expects the amended Employment Equity Bill to be tabled in Parliament. Now, apparently, this will empower the Labour Minister to regulate sector-specific employment equity targets and make an EE compliance certificate as a prerequisite for accessing state contracts. So, yet more regulation, more red tape, more complication.
I haven't seen the text yet, so I don't know. Any clue as to what's in it?
Well, it's transformation. They want, for example, to... They've released an employment equity report, which shows 65.6% of top management positions are still occupied by white South Africans. And the Commission for Employment Equity chairperson, Tabia Kabinde, said that at the broad level, the trends continue to paint a picture of a very slow but steady pace of transformation, especially at the top four occupation levels. And he expects that when employers are slow in transforming, worker activism will nudge the employers. But this bill seeks to actually put very specific targets into play.
See, the really interesting thing for me is that no one ever pays any attention to the bottom part of the pyramid. Now, technically, if you're implementing employment equity across the board, then the lowest rungs of employment should actually reflect the demographics of the country as well. But I don't see any white males represented in mining, for example, on the ground. Have you?
No.
Well, now that's an interesting thing for me, and I want to see someone actually take up a court case that's then going to take the mines to court and say, why are you not employing more poor white people as miners?
No one's going to do that, though, because no one wants those jobs, right?
So it's, yeah, of course.
So it's actually the politics of resentment.
It's the politics of resentment. So nobody, for example, is interested in saying, why are there more... why are there not 50% women working as sewerage workers?
Yeah, nobody talks about that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So let's take a look at that at some other point in the future, because it's still a bill, so it's not,
yes,
not signed into law. The president has been signing a lot of things into law, though, and these are things that probably require some of our attention. You want to talk about ARTO? Do you want to talk about the...
One of the things that I wanted to touch on, I tweeted about it this morning, and I just wanted to touch on it very quickly, was the situation that went down in Hong Kong, where, and I'll just explain.
Okay, so we're going international. That's
fine. Well, it's international at one level, but actually there's kind of a philosophical backbone to this. So what's really happened is that a group of activists in Hong Kong put together an app that would allow them to track the movements of the Hong Kong police. Which is kind of not very different to what Pigspotter does down here, which is to tell us where all of the where the speed traps are. But they were using the same thing in the context of Hong Kong to basically track where all the police presence were, because they tried to get themselves organized. And so Apple then had a complaint from the Hong Kong authorities. And for Hong Kong authorities, you can basically read Beijing, that says that it's irresponsible of them to be allowing an app that's allowing public violence. And so Apple has now pulled the app from their app store in Hong Kong, even though Hong Kong is a special administrative region that theoretically runs differently from the way in which the rest of China runs. But you see, the interesting philosophical point for me around here is that because we've had concentration of power in the hands of a few tech companies. So if you look in terms of the biggest companies in the world right now, we've got Apple,
Amazon,
Microsoft. Well, Microsoft doesn't really play in that same space, so I'll just take them out of the equation. But you've got Microsoft, you've got Amazon, and you've got Google, Alphabet, and Apple, yes. And, you know, I said at the time when Steve Jobs launched the App Store, I said essentially what Steve Jobs has done is he's put up the first toll roads on the information superhighway.
Mm-hmm.
And what that essentially means is it becomes very easy for powerful states, in this case being the United States and China specifically, to then close off access to those ecosystems as they see fit. So, for example, you had that app that came out of Russia that ages you. I forget what it was called.
FaceApp.
Yeah, that was it. Which immediately the Americans turned around and said, no, this was allowing the Russians to steal your identity. And so there was a campaign that came out against that. But what this is now going to lead to is a scenario where people are increasingly going to want to have operating systems running on their phones that are not going to be encumbered by these large companies.
Because these large companies will kowtow to political interests and political pressures.
Absolutely. If you use Apple very specifically, Apple removed the emoji for the Taiwanese flag.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Sure.
So just simply because of the fact that they bow to pressure from Beijing around that. And Apple at the same time... allowed its servers for its messaging system to then be based in Beijing, again, because of the fact that Beijing had insisted that this happened. So when you have a scenario where you have people who are developing these independent apps, they're going to want to be free of Apple's ecosystem or Google's ecosystem or any of those, because you want to prevent yourself from being shut down. I mean, consider, for example, why is it that we've never seen an app for Pornhub?
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's because of the fact that in terms of Apple's guidelines and in terms of Google's guidelines,
they won't allow you to have.
They won't allow you to pop it up in those stores. But you can still access those sites via your phone. It just means that you go through
a browser,
through a web browser. Yes. So I think increasingly we're going to see a scenario where people are cutting themselves loose from those ecosystems.
Which is good.
Which is great.
Free market.
Yeah, which is really great.
Something that the Chinese have trouble understanding.
Yes, and I think it's great that the Chinese, by putting pressure on the large tech companies, are actually forcing the democratization of these platforms.
Yeah, because there are only two ways, right? You either comply...
Or you go outside.
Yeah. Or you go outside.
Yeah, so cryptocurrency is being a case in point.
All right. Well, I'm always pleased when you talk about self-sufficiency and not having to rely on people. And I know that you're a big get-off-the-grid guy and you're a big borehole rather than use municipal water guy. But there are some things that I suppose we still have to figure out. And one of those is how we respond to big tech companies who essentially are hegemonic and they decide a lot of things for us without our say-so even being a part of the equation.
Sure. You know, I have a scenario where, I follow 100 people only on Twitter and I still get a situation where Twitter does not show me tweets from specific people on that list of 100. Hmm. And I have to actually
go looking for it. And we know Google searches, for example, if you look for certain things on Google, it just doesn't come up.
Sure, they always skew it in particular directions.
Yeah. If you go on to DuckDuckGo or wherever else you might go, totally different results.
Different scenario, yeah.
And you find whole swathes of information are just ignored by those search engines.
Yep.
All right, let's go to Mike Apple, who's with ENCA, and find out what he has to say about the State Capture Commission. He's been, for his sins, he's had to go and pay attention there for the last couple of days. Michael, have you died of boredom yet, or are you enjoying the performance?
Or has my tolerance for, how do I put this politely? Sort of having my bullshit meter skyrocket sometimes. I haven't died of boredom. It depends on the person on the witness stand, but yeah.
Well, Canthan and I were talking about what a polished performance Duduzane Zuma did this week, and a lot of people are very impressed with him, but they're the same people who like watching the Oscars. Now, if Duduzane Zuma said anything important, you'll tell us, right? You won't forget to throw that in there, because the rest of us couldn't be bothered to watch his testimony. What did he say that was of import?
So that he's a victim of the South African media having painted him as the poster child for corruption, that he is a person caught in a political storm not of his own making, simply by virtue of being the son of the then former president, or then sitting president, now former, that he was a businessman caught in between all the political ructions that were going on in the country. And you can't tell him who to choose as his friends, and he just happens to be so good at business that the Guptas decided to choose him as a business partner, because, you know, of course, it played no strategic relation to who his father was. And if everybody could just believe that he is an honest and good man, and stop looking at him when they see him on the street, these are his words, that people look at me and they believe I'm the person that spirited or plundered trillions of rands out of the country. And, quote, by the way, that's not true.
Just by the way.
Yeah.
Interesting choice of words. Now, did Justice Zondo have anything to say to this, or did he just let him talk and then say thank you very much and let him leave?
So the inquiry chair, and it's become painfully clear, is probably the fairest person I've ever come across. So even when 90% of the room may be rolling their eyes and maybe saying to themselves, please, you need to challenge that, or the evidence leader here needs to challenge something, he is so patient, and he's just so composed. Yep. And so fair that he just thanks everybody, and he really tries to interrogate, even if it's a narrative which we can see is pork pies perhaps, that he just lets the person finish their point and then he thanks them. He's just like, he's such a fair guy that sometimes it is painful to watch. But no, he didn't interject young Mr. Zuma in any way. He did say to him at times, look, I have to be transparent. And I am finding some concerns with your story. Like, why go to the Gupta's house for a private meeting when your house is 600 meters down the road? To which he responded, I don't do business meetings at my house. Which is just strange.
Yeah, there's a lot that's strange here, but we don't really know what do designer Zuma's doing at the moment, do we? I mean, it's not clear what his business is and where he's involved and where he even lives most of the year.
So he's living in Dubai at the moment. That's my understanding. What exactly he is doing at the moment, I'm not sure. I do believe the money well has dried up.
He's never produced a product. He doesn't perform any particular service in the world right now. I'm trying to find what his value add is, what it is that he might be able to do, since he's such a great businessman that the Guptas couldn't avoid but to use him. I'm trying to figure out, has he cured cancer? Has he perhaps got has he got some sort of product that we all need to buy, like an iPhone that he's engineered all on his own? What's he doing?
Well, can I offer perhaps a radical answer here?
Please do.
His value add is that he is Duduzade, wait for it, Zuma. Ah. That is his radical value add. His proximity to his father and who he was able to spirit away to certain meetings, obviously with their permission, he says.
He did admit that there was a meeting with Mkabisi Jonas, but he said that what Jonas said happened in the meeting didn't happen. But this is interesting because the Guptas, of course, said there wasn't a meeting at all. Duduzane is now obviously running counter to their original statement that there was no such meeting. There was, in fact, according to him.
Yes. So the Guptas said there was no meeting, as did Oak Bay Investments, a company he was a director in. They also said there was absolutely no meeting, and they put that statement out on behalf of the Gupta family. So that's two versions from the Guptas, which counters his own. He wasn't able to explain that, to be honest. But yeah, he says that meeting happened. And here's the question. Why would Mpolisi Dukwana, the former MEC for Economic Development, who says ACE was at a meeting he was at, why would Johan Boysen, a career cop, why would Nwako Ramaphosa, a veteran ANC and former mineral resources minister, why, and Fakey Mentor, let's throw in the mix as well, why would all these people lie? What is the benefit to them if all of them who spoke up about having been somewhere where the Guptas were and an offer was made either got fired or discredited, lost their jobs, or got completely shunned within their own party? There was nothing for them to gain if the reality is they all lost after speaking out.
Hmm. Who else is going to be appearing in the next couple of weeks? What's next on this great TV series, The State Capture Inquiry?
So we just don't know, unfortunately. We do know that number one is coming back.
Oh. Jacob Gedleyihle Zuma.
Yes, the Don is coming back. So he is back due in November, I think. And this time he is going to have had full prior knowledge, let's say, of the, quote, areas of interest that the inquiry is interested in. So they said they never sent him questions because the inquiry would never do that and make special provision for Mr. Zuma. But they said they just sent him an 11-page, 80-question thing areas of interest. They just sent him area of interest so that he has very specific knowledge of what they want to question him on.
How long do you think this is going to keep going for? I know that there are specific timelines for when it should end, according to its original establishment, but how long is the State Capture Inquiry going to carry on, and what are we really expecting in practical terms for findings that may be useful?
So it's supposed to be, well, initially, when Tuli Maroncela wrote that State Capture report, she said it must be wrapped up within 6 months, and I mean, I think that was admirable, but I think slightly unrealistic. So they went to court and they asked for at least 2 years. So I think it's either a 2-year extension or a 6-month extension. So I think all in all, it's supposed to take about, so strap yourself in for about 2.5 years.
Oh.
And at my last calculation, I did a bit of a, if we assume that their budget for 6 months was a certain amount, I worked it out that it would cost about 960 million rand for this commission.
So what's their budget per day there, Mike?
It's very difficult. They don't tell us. All we know is that I think we last saw that 362 million has been spent so far, and it's been just over a year. Now, that would include catering.
So it's about a million rand a day, pretty much.
Pretty much. And I'm not entirely sure what the breakdown is.
Hold on. Yeah, Mike, I'm curious how that could even amount to a million rand a day. I mean, you know, you can have people who put on events with entertainment and lights and smoke machines and dances and food and drink, and it wouldn't cost a million rand a day. What on God's green earth costs a million rand a day when it's a bunch of people sitting in a room telling stories?
So, and this is an interesting fact I didn't know. When the former NDPP, Mpolisi Masana,
yes,
when he appeared there, he pleaded poverty, and he wanted to raise issues with, every day he sits at the inquiry is a day he can't be out there making money. And then they said, oh, but don't worry, you can ask for appearance fees.
Oh.
So as an attorney that appears there being questioned, you can get paid by the state capture inquiry for appearing there.
And
I didn't know that.
If I write to Justice Sondona, I want to appear before
exactly. The state.
Exactly. If Canthen and I write a letter to him now and say we've got some information, even if it's bullshit, like Duduzane's testimony was bullshit, and we arrive and we say we need 3 days at least, and Canthen and I spin a big story, which is totally made up, we could get paid for our time.
Ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching. You come up with a business idea.
Wow, this is good stuff. All right, Michael, you've been more useful than you know.
Gareth, just lastly, look, why it could possibly cost that much? You have a Deputy Chief Justice who sits there who obviously gets paid daily. They're paying Tiso Black Star for that lovely venue on the fourth floor. They are paying for catering for everybody else but journalists, much to my annoyance, but I understand it. We don't even get Wi-Fi or water. They are paying for security. They are paying the evidence leaders, and there's obviously some of the best legal brains in the country sit and work exclusively now for this inquiry. And sometimes they have to pay for those who come and testify before the nation.
Well, I think it's highly unlikely that Zondo's salary is coming out of that budget, because I think that he gets paid as part of the judiciary overall, and he's just redeployed to this environment right now. So in fact, the amount of money that's being spent on the other things is probably considerably higher as a result.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
All right, Michael, thank you so much. Always good to connect with you, and keep an eye on what's going on there for us, will you?
Thanks a lot, Gareth.
Thank you. All right, maybe Canthen, we should go there.
All right.
Make an appearance.
Yeah, I think so.
See, I cancel New York. I'm going to the state capture inquiry to waffle for hours and get paid. Sounds excellent. All right, we didn't even get a chance to look at international things, but just briefly, the Trump impeachment thing seems to be ratcheting up, according to Democrats. According to Republicans, it's ratcheting down. What the hell's going to happen there? Because I think people are interested.
Look, I think the most interesting thing has that been that Trump is now starting to troll Hillary again and saying, why don't you step back into the ring? And more interestingly, Hillary responds with, don't tempt me. And I think that this is a really interesting turn of events.
Well, I think in terms of the impeachment thing, the other thing that came out that's quite interesting is that it would appear that the Democrats did have information, certainly one or two of the Democrats, I'll get to naming them in a second, had information that was privy to them before it was put out to the correct authorities. And there's one congressman in particular who's very loud and mouthy about Donald Trump, and went on about the Russian collusion story to the nth degree, actually set himself up as a permanent fixture on CNN during the time in question, and is now also the conduit for this information into the Democratic Party. It doesn't seem that this is a very wholesome affair altogether.
No, but American politics has never been wholesome. But I love American politics because there are those checks and balances. The House can say we want him impeached, and then it'll go before the Senate, and the Senate will say, well, actually, we're not going to give you a two-thirds vote in favor of this. And meanwhile, we've got the sideshow while Trump is pulling out of Turkey, pulling out of Syria, and
What do you think of that? Because the Kurds have been left high and dry now, obviously. Look, this is a very bad thing.
Look, the Kurds have been left high and dry ever since the carving up of the Ottoman Empire at the, you know, after...
It's the largest ethnic minority without a homeland.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And the only reason why the Kurds have never ended up with a homeland has been because of political expediency on the part of everyone. And the fact is that the Kurds, yes, have been a backstop for the U.S. In terms of, firstly, the war with Iraq, going back to the first Gulf War in the 90s, and you know everything around the way in which the world has engaged with the Kurds has been, well, we're going to support you behind the scenes, but no, actually, we're not going to make out a case for your statehood because it might upset Turkey because they're part of NATO. It might upset
Syria and Iraq.
Yeah, but. Yeah. Yeah,
but this is duplicitous of Trump, and I don't think a particularly good.
No, well, it's not. I don't want to single out. I don't want to single out Trump on this part because it was exactly Obama's policy as well to support the Kurds behind the scenes, and George W. Bush before that. The Kurds are basically screwed. It's kind of like the Tibetans. You know, they're basically screwed.
Titties.
Yeah, tough titties.
Just quickly, for your edification this morning, I have a fat boy slim sample of Greta Thunberg's speech to the UN during a UK concert that he recently performed. Take a listen to this.
People are dying.
This is at a party, by the way. This is millennial slacktivism at its best, all right? Are you ready, everybody? Let's party.
We will not let you get away with this. Right here, right now, is where we draw the line.
Right here.
The world
right
is waking up. And change is coming.
Very good. Right here, right now, which is the actual name of the original song. And there's Greta laid over it. Very nice.
I liked the death metal version, by the way.
All right.
It is out there. Go look
for it.
Maybe
we'll play that for you next time. Thank you, Canthan. That is The Burning Platform, brought to you by Nando's every Thursday. Canthan Pillay. And thank you to Michael Apple from ENCA for joining us too. Most especially thank you to you. And we will see you tomorrow. See ya. Enjoy your flight to Washington.
Thank you very much. I'll arrive in one piece.
Well, we hope so.
Don't put that out there. I will arrive in one piece.
All right. Thank you very much. CliffCentral.com